Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 23rd of July 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, we are not live. This is pre-recorded, but I do have with me my co-host for the show, of course, who is the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Sun's out again, which is great. So, it's all good. I always find I'm in a better mood when the sun's out.
It's a beautiful summer, isn't it? It is certainly, we're certainly having a bit of a heat wave at the moment, or we are when we are recording this. And we had a couple of things that we were brought up in the last episode. One of them was actually the climate, what the climate was like back at the time that we were talking about. And I looked this up, looking up the climate on the weather web, they estimate that by 3500 BC, all the glaciers were gone from Britain, with a tree line 100 metres higher than now. And because that tree line was 100 metres higher, they think that that meant that there was less wind. So it was basically a milder climate in 3500. Then from 3500 to 300, it was warmer than it is today. So this sort of blows it out of the sky, doesn't it? This global warming and what a threat that is. It was warmer than it is today between 3500 to 3000. But then towards the end, the summer warmth became less reliable around about 3000 BC. Then it warmed up again and there were clear skies. And we know that there were clear skies as the Stone Circle observatories were built in this period. And then 2200 BC, there was a volcanic eruption in Iceland, which caused bitterly cold winters and unreliable summers. And then in 1500 BC, it got cooler and wetter. From then on, up until about 1100 BC, where it got warmer again. And basically, it gets warmer and it gets colder and it gets warmer and it gets colder. So what we're seeing today with this climate panic is it's nothing that we haven't seen before, and it's perfectly natural. And I guess we were looking at this just to really sort of see how habitable Britain was at the time. So what they're saying is 3500 BC, all the glaciers were gone, but it still must have been fairly cold for there to have been glaciers there up until that point. So there can't have been people living there when there were glaciers there. And then as the glaciers receded, more people would have moved in, but there really wouldn't have been many people, I don't think, in Britain at the time. Do you think?
No, I shouldn't have thought so. I mean, same with, it would have affected most of Europe, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Or is this mostly Britain?
Well, this is mainly dealing with Britain, but obviously, you know, Northern Europe is going to be the same.
Yeah, I'd have thought so. Yeah, I mean, if people will migrate to areas where they can, you know, be fruitful and plant and utilize all the agricultural skills that they have. So I'd have thought that if it's volatile, people wouldn't be able to populate as fast and consistently as they could, you know, after 1500 BC, where it's said to have got warmer and probably less volatile.
Yeah, that ties in with when it really seemed to become more populated. And talking about the population, the most recent estimate for the worldwide population in 2000 BC is 70 million, which I think is roughly the population of Great Britain today. I was thinking it's the population of England, but I think England's only about 60 million. So if you include the whole of the United Kingdom, it's about 70 million. And that was the whole worldwide population of human beings. So that's what they estimated at in 2000 BC. So there really wouldn't have been that many people here in Britain. There really couldn't have been, because you need quite a large number of people to have a community. You can't just have a human being living on his own. You have to have a community to provide all the things that you need. One man can't make it all for himself. He has to rely on everybody else. So we had the big centres of human population were in the Fertile Crescent, and then we had colonist expeditions going out looking for resources elsewhere. And because Britain was full of the resource of tin, they would have been encampments that built up into towns and defences to protect the tin as well. And they would have been the first settlements, I think, on the coast in Britain. Do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah. No, it would have been, it was mostly facilitated from trade, wasn't it? So, and I guess I'm just wondering and curious, based on the 70 million, how many, you know, what kind of percentages it would have been with regards to racial, you know, differences. So how, essentially, how many were white? How many would have been of a different race, different stock?
I think the majority of them would have been white. I don't think there were that many blacks in South Sudan or south of the Sahara. And then we had the Arab types were just in the Fertile Crescent, and they claimed that they were created by the Anunnaki. And that was it, really. I think it was in the Fertile Crescent there. I don't think there would have been many people outside of it. Probably, I don't know, 80% white, 20% non-white. But you just don't know how they get to these figures as well. 70 million. True. How do they work that out? Is that just by looking at the numbers today and looking back over the last 100 years, or as long as they've been taking the census? And, you know, it's difficult to estimate going back all that far.
Yeah, I mean, they obviously do it on the data that they have. So you're probably looking at a range, aren't you? It could have been 50 million. It could have been 100 million.
Yeah,
but you know for sure that it's not going to have been, you know, well over a billion. I mean, that's it. Just nothing it wouldn't have been like that at all.
Nothing like today. And also last week when I said it's hard to find a time when we were not living alongside Jews or non-whites, I was talking about the empires in the Near East. Because obviously we did so later in Europe, basically for around 1,000 years after the time of Christ in Britain. It wasn't until 1066 until the Jews came into Britain alongside William the Conqueror. And we also questioned when it was that the tribe of Asher took over Phoenicia, and this can be dated to around 1500 BC, which is the date of the Armana letters, which are letters from the Hittites to the Egyptian pharaoh begging him for help, because Joshua was making war against them. So that we can time that period there. That's when Joshua made war against the Hittites. That's when the tribe of Asher took over Phoenicia. And I was also listening to Chris DeGinia podcast last weekend, and Bill was saying that the old historians, when they talk about the colonists from Phoenicia, they only mention Tyre. They don't mention Byblos. And Tyre was the city that the Israelites completely destroyed, and then they completely rebuilt it. And the colonists came out from Tyre, and they called them the Tyrian Phoenicians. Only they can only have been Israelites. So that would have been this tribe of Asher, because they also colonized Carthage and some other areas as well. We'll look at this in depth when we look at Phoenicia. Getting back to Cornwall, we were talking about this date 1500 BC. We know that that's when the Phoenicians were Israelites, but Cornwall was being mined for tin long before then, though. And at the time it was needed for the Bronze Age to begin in Sumer, the area that was later known as Phoenicia was occupied by whites from Assyria. And as we discussed last week, the earliest mentions of tin in the Near East were Assyrian from 2500 BC. So whites from there would have travelled to Britain for the tin and set up small communities there, and they would have been Japhethites or Shemites. The land later took the name Phoenicia after it was split between the Hittites and the Phoenicians, who were then driven out by the Israelites into what is now Turkey, and that was around 1500 BC. And the textual references to Phoenician traders collecting the tin from the inhabitants of Britain are all from around 500 BC and onwards, which is long after Phoenicia had been occupied by the Israelites. As I say, we will be looking at Phoenicia in detail later in the series, but for now, we will stay with Cornwall. Do you want to add anything to that?
Since we're just reiterating some things from last podcast, we mentioned about how, although, you know, we may have lived quite closely with, you know, other racial groups in times, like some of the Phoenicians and the sort of old Canaanites and some Jews and whatnot, that we pretty much back then had a strong priority of maintaining racial purity, didn't we?
And, oh, yes.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to note is that's evident in certain surnames. For example, in Scots, they tend to have Muck in front of their name, which essentially means son of. So I think you have that in a lot of different, you know, European type surnames, you know, son of, and it kind of just shows how important, you know, being in the offspring of your father was, and maintaining that racial purity.
Oh, very important. I mean, sometimes they would have concubines, and the offspring of the concubines were nowhere near as important as the direct firstborn son. I mean, what they ended up having to do was make it so that the land couldn't be sold on. So you couldn't actually sell your land, because the land would always go to the firstborn son, and that would be passed on to him. And that meant that the other sons had to go out as colonists and find new areas. And one of the things that we did with democracy is we said, oh, well, no, that's wrong. Everything should be shared out equally between everyone. And if you share everything out equally, everyone gets a tiny little piece and they can't really do anything with it. If everything goes to the firstborn son, then you get like a huge estate. And there was also this idea of the Jubilee. Every 40 years, everything would be zeroed. All debts would be zeroed. And this meant that people managed to keep their wealth, and it was all dynastic wealth. We also talked about the Druids last week and how they had to show that they had been part of the same family, a free man, for 10 generations back. So did the Levites. If you look at the Book of the Danes, it's very important there who your parentage is. Also, again, as we mentioned last week, if you look at the Israelites when they went into Jericho, there were other Israelites there that were preserving the line of Judah. And they used as a symbol, they used a scarlet flag, which was the symbol of Judah. So even when they were living amongst these peoples, they would still preserve their genetic integrity and would not do the same as the peoples around them did, particularly the Hittites and the Canaanites. They would intermingle and intermix with these other races. And obviously white people didn't do that, because we're still white. If we weren't white, then you can tell that in our ancestry we had mixed with these other races. But the very fact that we are white tells us that none of our ancestors took wives of a strange god, because we're white. That is the proof of it. We are the sum of all our ancestors. Moving back to Cornwall then, and this is quoting from the PLOS One study. During the 1970s and the 80s, archaeologists found tin ingots all across the Middle East. But only now, with new technology, have they been able to learn exactly where the tin was sourced. These ingots and related remains were dated to around 1200 BC. Through isotopic analysis and other analysis of trace elements, the interdisciplinary German, Italian, American and Israeli researchers were able to deduce the tin's origin. They analysed 27 blocks of tin from several locations in the Mediterranean and found that those from the area of Haifa were sourced from a different location than the others found around the Mediterranean basin. And this tin was sourced from the mines in Cornwall, England. And Haifa is in the land that is now called Israel. So again, this just gives us a connection between the Israelites and the tin. So from 1200 BCE, the tin that was in Judea, which it was called at that time, came from Cornwall. And that's a very modern study there. And I've also got a quote from Project Ancient Tin 2020, and they say the tin required to make the bronze that fueled the Near Eastern civilizations was particularly scarce, and yet there was a huge demand for it. As Britain possessed probably the richest tin deposits in Europe that were easily worked and transported, there has long been speculation that Britain traded tin across the continent and even supplied the civilizations in the Eastern Mediterranean. Now that the sensitivity and accuracy of analytical techniques have greatly improved, there is an opportunity with this project to establish chemical and isotopic fingerprints for British tin sources. This will allow us to explore whether Britain's exceptionally rich tin deposits fueled the European Bronze Age. Identifying a major role in the huge European metal trading network for the apparently isolated small farming and mining communities of Bronze Age Britain would radically change the perception of the island's prehistory. There is now good evidence for trade in amber and tin between Northern Europe and the British Isles, and some evidence for the extension of this trading pattern down the river valleys of Europe into the Mediterranean and the Adriatic. The Mycenaeans would not themselves have gone to Northern Europe or the British Isles, but they would have become prosperous by controlling the southern, presumably maritime, end of the trade route. So there's more and more evidence that is coming out that is confirming what the ancients said, that, that the tin came from Britain and it made its way across to the Mediterranean and into the Fertile Crescent. And Britain was very important, vital to all of this.
So given that if we assume that the Britain or Albion, as it was known back then, you know, did produce all of the tin, what kind of, just to kind of give a general overview of the ramifications that that has for the, you know, if the wider known world were to know, or to, just to be general knowledge.
Well, at the time it was hidden. At the time it was hidden because they didn't want anybody to discover where the tin was coming from. So it was closely guarded. That's why in those Assyrian texts, it doesn't actually mention where it's coming from. It just tells you about these merchants and they're getting it from somewhere. It meant that the civilization in Britain would have been able to spring up in Britain first before anywhere else, because it was one of the would have been one of the earliest places that were settled. And this is why when Julius Caesar came to Britain, there were 40 universities in Britain, 40 university cities, and all the aristocracy of Gaul, and Gaul is a huge area, were coming to Britain to be educated at these universities. And this is also why we find remains of swords, we find remains of money. We had our own coinage before Julius Caesar came. So we had an economy, we had roads, we had chariots. It was an important place. It wasn't barbaric. It wasn't backwards people. It was people up to the same standard of civilization as the Romans were. And that's why Julius Caesar wanted to get there. And it shows that Britain played a very important part back then, the same as it is today. And the European Union didn't want to lose Britain because of the trade and how much trade Britain is responsible for. Back then, Britain was also very important, and that would have been where a lot of the wealth came from. And this is surprising because you often think, well, the wealth for the British Empire must have come from the Jews, because that's why people wanted the Jews to come back from Holland, because they saw that Holland was building an empire and they had the Dutch East India Trading Company, and they wanted the Jews with their wealth and their gold to come back to Britain. But in actual fact, because of these tin mines, Britain would have been exceedingly wealthy anyway, just because of this. And this is what, and these tin miners were so important as well. I mean, they were above the law, basically, because they knew how to extract the tin, and it was the tin that made the most wealth for Britain. So I guess that's sort of some of the ramifications of this. And it shows we can't have been backwards people. You know, we weren't cavemen. We were up to the same standards of civilization as they were in the Fertile Crescent. I guess we would have lived in wooden houses, really, or cob houses. And cob rots down over time. I mean, we have the old hut circles, which you can find on Dartmoor and Bodmin Moor and in the west. And you find remains of cities and castles like Maiden Castle in Dorset. I mean, a lot of these places are now just earthworks, but they show that there must have been huge cities there before. And when you look in the Near East, it's similar there. They have like a mound of dirt, which is called a tell, and that's basically an old city where they just built on top of the city that was there before. And in Mesopotamia, they made the houses out of these mud bricks, the same substance that they were using to make these clay tablets. So they would make houses out of that, and then when that would start getting a bit manky, they would knock it down and just build another one on top. And I think maybe they did the same in Britain, because we also have these old mounds that are the remains of our cities. And I think we had our own language as well, and there are some people that say that was the Colbran alphabet, and things were written in Colbran. Which again, that gets sort of brushed over today, because they don't want people. They want people to think that we were idiots until the Romans came, and it basically it completely disproves that. I mean, we can't have been idiots, because we defeated the Romans twice anyway, and our history tells us that one of our kings went over to Rome, well, two of them, Brennus and Belinus, and they just completely destroyed the Romans and the Etruscans, and they took over. And it was their descendants that became the first Romans and the ones that were known for all the poetry and all the writing. They were actually descendants from these Cymric types that went over there. And I think it was about 600 BC. I covered that in the Greatest Britain series. If anyone is interested in learning about that, there's three or four episodes all to do with Britain's interactions with the Romans, because most people aren't aware of it. That, you know, we defeated the modern Rome twice. And the third time when Julius Caesar came over, it took him years to come to a treaty with us. But before that, even in 600 BC, we actually went to Rome and we sacked Rome and put our kings in charge. And that remained as the blackest day ever in the Roman Empire, is when Brennus and Belinus went over there and sacked the place in 600 BC. So
was that after Romulus or before?
Oh, after Romulus. Romulus is one of the Romulus and Remus, I think, were the two boys that brought up by a wolf, weren't they?
Yeah, sorry, I got mixed up. Brutus. Sorry, you say Brutus went on to establish.
Oh, it was after Brutus. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Is one of his descendants, Brennus and Belinus. Again, yeah. We're getting a little bit off topic here. Let's get back to the tin, because we have a Wikipedia, we have what Wikipedia say about it as well. They say it has been claimed that tin was first mined in Europe around 2500 BC in the Erzgebirge, and knowledge of tin, bronze and tin extraction techniques spread from there to Brittany and Cornwall around 2000 BC, and from northwestern Europe to northwestern Spain and Portugal around the same time. However, the only Bronze Age object from Central Europe whose tin has been scientifically provenanced is the Niebuhr Sky Disk, and its tin is shown by tin isotopes to have come from Cornwall. In addition, a rare find of a pure tin ingot in Scandinavia was provenanced to Cornwall. Available evidence, although very limited, thus points to Cornwall as the sole early source of tin in Central and Northern Europe. Cornwall maintained its importance as a source of tin throughout medieval times and into the modern period. And as we discussed last week, the knowledge of how to make bronze, it began in Britain, and then it made its way to Scandinavia. And the very last place it got to was Spain and Iberia. The places that were actually closest to the Fertile Crescent, at that part of the Mediterranean, they were the last countries to actually know how to use bronze. It began in Cornwall, in Britain. And I think with these explorers that would have come from the Fertile Crescent, that would have come from Assyria. So even Wikipedia is admitting it, although the mainstream narrative is that it was first mined in 2500 BC in the Erzgebirge, but there's no real evidence for that, apart from that they don't want Britain to appear that important, because it upsets the rest of their historical narrative, really.
Yeah. Well, it goes for most mainstream science, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope we're sort of challenging it here and challenging it in ways that, you know, people can check out for themselves and research this for themselves. I mean, these are all mainstream sources that I've used there on the tin trade. And I've got some other sources now that maybe they're not quite so mainstream, but they also explain how this happened. By the 11th century BC, the tribe of Asher, under the name Phoenician, had passed out of the Mediterranean, coasting along Spain and Gaul, and established a trade with the Tin Islands, which were, according to the Universal Encyclopedia, were the Scilly Isles and Cornwall. And the Phoenicians, we now realise, who according to many writers made settlements in Britain, were actually of the Israel tribe of Asher, and were not of the Hamitic race of Canaan, but were of the race of Shem. The descendants of Ham's youngest son Canaan, upon whom Noah uttered a far-reaching curse of servitude, were because of that curse powerless to gain supremacy in private or national enterprise. A servant of servants precisely describes the Canaanites' position as vassals of Egypt and of the Hittites, who were conquered by Egypt and were under vassalage to their conquerors. Hence, the servant of servants were under vassalage to vassals. The reputed colonization of Cornwall by Phoenicians rests upon the same assumption as that of Phoenician Ireland. The nomenclature Phoenician Cornwall and Phoenician Ireland are without foundation in historical fact. Bruce Hannay, in his Race Origins, states the Phoenicians were Israelites. And this explains why no Phoenician antiquities and no Phoenician graves have ever been discovered in Cornwall or in Ireland. Yet the historians of the time record the Phoenicians being here in Britain. And this is because they were Israelites. As we said, in 1500 BC, the Israelites took over Phoenicia and they expelled all the Canaanites from there. All the tribes that were from there, they kicked out. And they destroyed Tyre and they rebuilt Tyre. And that whole strip there of Lebanon, that's now called Lebanon, that was part of the territory of Israel and Judah. And they sent their ships out from there to Britain and elsewhere, basically, colonizing throughout Europe and looking for resources.
Yeah, so they were essentially just very nomadic, weren't they? And they obviously had their boats and whatnot, which are very similar to a lot of the Viking boats that you see. If you look at Phoenician ships, they're almost identical.
And the Egyptian ones
mentioned.
And the Egyptian ones. I think they found one of these ships. I think maybe in the northeast, just off of Hull, somewhere like that. And I think they said that was from 600 BC. And I mean, it was one of these, exactly the same as these Phoenician ships. But also you think, you know, the British are known for being a maritime race. We're known for sailing all around the world. And this is where it came from. This is where we first set out from, was from that beach there at Lebanon. And also the Greeks were known for this. I mean, it's just something that white people are known for. And the nomadic thing, the exploring thing as well, wanting to go out and colonize it. And as I say, the reason for that was because everything went to the firstborn son, and there were big families, so there may have been, you know, 10 sons, and everything that the father has is going to go to the firstborn son. So what are the other nine of the 10 going to do? Well, they're going to have to leave and colonize somewhere else and then set up their own place, aren't they? So that spurred people on to go out and explore, which is a good thing, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's an incentive.
You know, democratizing it all and equality, it's put a stop to that, really.
Yeah. So, I mean, there were other Phoenician settlements, such as Carthage, which you mentioned, and there was the old famous military leader, Hannibal, and he was clearly white, if you see depictions of him.
Yeah, the black Africans try to hijack the Phoenicians because they set up Carthage, and I think this was in honor of an Israelite princess called Dido, in actual fact, something to do with that. We'll get into this when we look at Phoenicia, but Carthage was set up, and that became, you know, the central place, and Rome went to war against them with the Punic Wars, but it was all white people there, white people and also Canaanite types. But because it was in North Africa, now they claim that it must have been black people because it was in North Africa. It's like claiming that Henry Ford was black because Detroit is filled with black people today.
Well, that's it, exactly. Just ridiculous. I mean, it's essentially Carthage today is Tunisia, right?
Yes,
and Tunisia isn't full of any black people, really. It's you know, a kind of more mulatto type mixture, isn't it? So it's like, well, what happened to you guys then?
Yeah, when you see that, it's obvious what happened, isn't it? You know, the white people interbred with the black people, and that's what created the race that are there now, and that's why the place is in ruins, because they ceased to be able to maintain the civilization because they weren't the people that built it in the first place. They lost their genetic integrity. There's an old phrase, it's what happened to Athens? Well, they stopped being Athenian, or words to that effect, and that's why Athens fell. And it's the same with Rome. What happened to Rome? Well, they made all the slaves into citizens, and the original Romans that built the place, they were no longer around, and the only thing that kept it going then was the Germanic tribes, the Saxons, when they invaded, because they still had the pure white stock, and even though they were barbarians, they still had what it took to keep Rome going when it was collapsing in decadence, basically. There's a bit about the Vandals going over to Africa as well and being scandalized by the debauchery that they saw that was going on over there in North Africa. And they had a much better morality than the Romans did. I think that's in a book called Are We a Declining Race? An Old Sailor's Verdict, which is a very good book by a British author. But I'm going off track here a little bit. We were just talking about burials here. The ancient Britons buried instead of burning their dead like the Romans, who during the Roman occupation of Britain heavily taxed them for it on every occasion. Despite this, however, they still adhered to their own customs. This, with the similarity of Welsh and Cornish words and whole sentences in the Hebrew language, leaves no doubt as to the origin of the British people. The oldest graves that have been discovered in Cornwall, the Harlyn Bay discoveries near Padstow, are remarkable for showing that the earliest settlers in Cornwall, who were also most probably the first tin workers, were buried exactly like the prehistoric Egyptians, in a crouching position on the left side with the knees almost touching the chin. So not only do we have a people that don't burn their dead like the Romans, but we have a people that bury their dead in exactly the same fashion as the prehistoric Egyptians did. And the prehistoric Egyptians would have basically been the same people that were in the Fertile Crescent. You know, the first civilization before they really had their dynasties and all the rest of it. They would have been part of the same people that set up the civilization there, the one in the Indus Valley, the one that was in Anatolia, the one that was in Crete, and they're all sort of almost like franchises of the original civilization, started up by people moving out from that first part where civilization flowered in Sumer.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, obviously the burial techniques are somewhat of a tradition, so there could be cultural ties there. The only other reason or explanation I could think of why they might have done the same burial type is if they were short on space and they needed to, you know, bury people in a, you know, as compact as possible. But that's probably not the case.
Yeah, there were cremations at some point, but I guess this shows that there's been different waves of peoples that have been coming into Britain, but they've always been white. There's never been any black Africans that developed the sail, and you need to have a sail to make a seaworthy boat. I mean, they may have had canoes, but they didn't have boats that were capable of actually leaving Africa or anything like that. And the Arab types just stayed where they were, in the cities, in the fertile bit. And the real adventurous types, they would have left there and made their way to Northern Europe until there were enough numbers in Northern Europe to build our own civilization here, while all the ones in the Fertile Crescent and in the Near East, while they were collapsing. Well, the earliest tin mining in Cornwall is found to also be around the time of the building of Stonehenge and other gigantic monuments in these islands. These were believed to have been erected by the Hyksos, the Shemitic descendants of Noah, who left Egypt upon their completion of the Great Pyramid. Their knowledge of astronomy led to their creation of zodiacal charts in earth and stone, and Stonehenge is built using the same unit of measurement as the Great Pyramid, the megalithic yard and the megalithic inch. In no other way can we account for prehistoric Egyptian graves in Cornwall and for a people with the scientific knowledge in prehistoric times to discover and instruct in the mining of tin and the building of astronomical observatories, unless they had come from the Fertile Crescent, which was the only place which had this knowledge at that time. And I guess a modern way of looking at it, they might say, oh, well, they just discovered this. They just invented this. But I don't think that's possible. These ideas, they have to be spread by language. They have to be spread by people. You know, you take an idea somewhere. It doesn't just suddenly occur to somebody to smash up granite, melt it at a certain temperature and add whatever it is to it. Wolfram, I think it is, to flash it so that you get the tin out of it. Somebody has to tell you how to do that. And also the astronomical observatories, because these stone circles and other megalithic structures that are put there, they all align with the planets. And that was a knowledge that you know, where did that come from? It kind of only come from these astronomers that were in the Fertile Crescent. So we have all these links to it.
Do you how do you suggest the you know, with the megalithic rocks, they kind of maneuvered them in place? I remember watching a documentary on the proposing how the ancient Egypts, you know, kind of got their rocks, the large bricks in place to build the pyramids. I wonder if they're any different, but I'll just kind of briefly go over it. But how they suggested it was is it's similar to how a 3D printer works, and they set the foundations first, and then they would brick by brick, or they created a cast, so to speak, you know, really large cast, and the brick was made there and then in position. So they'd fill it with the cement, and then it would set, and then they'd move on to the next brick, and they'd do brick by brick, layer by layer. And obviously they would have taken into account the astronomical alignments and the funnels and, you know, tunnels that wove in between, you know. So that to me sounded like quite a plausible theory. I don't know if that would have been a similar method to the megalithic rocks in the, such as the Stonehenge, but
well, no, because they're like they're not formed rocks. They're not bricks. They're great big chunks of stone. I mean, that they don't really know how they erected them, just because of the weight of them. I mean, some of these megalithic structures, the weight of the stone is just phenomenal. I mean, they could have used leverage. Maybe they could have dug the ground around one, or maybe those stones were there in that area, because if you think of glaciers, they moving ice, and they pick up the rocks with them, and they gradually move down the country, and then once the ice melts, it leaves the rocks there wherever it's taken it to. So it could feasibly have been these giant rocks around the countryside, and then they rearranged them. But I don't know how they rearranged them. And the actual engineering of the Great Pyramid, there's a lot about it that they really would have struggled to actually do today. You know, they really don't know how it was done. And the measurements on it are so accurate. Perhaps we could have a look at the Great Pyramid when we get to Egypt. I mean, what we're doing here is saying there's a connection between the two, especially this megalithic yard. If they use the same measurement, you know, how did they do that? Were they handing out rulers?
Yeah, I don't know. I think they, there was, in the same documentary, it was talking about they used to have units of water as a metric, like a drop. I didn't quite understand it at the time, but it was something to do with water. I'll link you the documentary, but because I think it would be worth discussing, or at least trying to break it down, because it's you know, it's a theory just as valid as any other theory.
So. Yeah, we'll do that when we get to Egypt. Getting back to these tin mines here, the merchants of Asher worked or farmed the tin mines not as slaves but as masters and exporters. See Camden's Britannica, Volume 1. No trace of Phoenician antiquities, graves, or influence has been discovered in either Gaul or Britain, and no vestige of Phoenician traders has ever been found. Yet native pre-Roman bronze objects have come to light in the Cornish tinworks. Whilst tin was discovered in the Iron Age village of Glastonbury, and it was used in minting British money before the Roman occupation. So this shows that we had the level of civilization required to make these bronze objects, the same as they had in the Fertile Crescent, and yet they were a different type to the ones that you would associate with the Phoenicians, with idols and things like that on them. So I think we had swords and weapons and coinage. Just having coinage is quite incredible. I think we've got coins going up to 200 BC, 300 BC, something like that. And they show a link to what was going on in the Fertile Crescent as well. That they've got similar sort of symbols on them that you see on the Sumerian cylinder seals. There's L.A. Waddell has done a lot of work on this, and he shows that the cup marks, and also the cup marks that you get on some stones are reminiscent of the same cup marks that you get on these cylinder seals, and you get them on the coins as well. And he traces St. Michael as going back to one of these guys originally that used to spear the dragon or used to spear the crocodile. It goes back to Egypt. There's all sorts of connections you can make between myths, which would show that the Near East and Britain, it was all one people. I mean, that's the only conclusion that you can come to, is that it was all white people. It wasn't the Arabs that are there now. The Reverend T. Taylor, in his book St. Michael's Mount, quotes Diodorus Siculus, who is said to have been quoting Posidonius, who asserts that the merchants who brought the tin at Ictus were neither Phoenician nor Carthaginian. An ancient name for St. Michael's Mount, which is in Cornwall, is believed to be discovered in the name Ictus or Mictus. The latter name would be more likely as an ancient variation of Michael. So Mictus is the same as Michael, basically. Pliny's quotation in Timaeus says, 6 days' sail inland from Britain, and he means Brittany, there is an island called Mictus, in which white lead is found, and to this island the Britons come in boats of osier covered with sewn hides, and that's coracles. And the history of the coracle is quite fantastic, the way we developed these little vessels that we could carry on our backs, and you see a man carrying a coracle and he looks like a giant beetle, and it's really light, mm-hmm. and yet with just this one paddle you can make your way across the water. I mean, there are tales of saints making their way from Cornwall to France in these coracles. It's a wonderful bit of engineering. You think it's so light, you can carry it over your shoulders, and it will work like an umbrella, and it will also it'll also work as a boat.
I'm looking at it now. It's just some images. I'd never heard of one before, but it's essentially like a turtle's shell, isn't it? But then you take it off, and then you basically use it for a boat.
It's really cute. I mean, they really are cute little things made out of basket wickerwork with a leather hide around them. I mean, it's just a different type of vessel to the Viking boats and the Phoenician Viking longships.
I mean, it doesn't look like they'd be able to travel too far. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's more like river based.
Yeah. Perfect for fishing. And lakes and rivers and locks and getting around on the water in Britain, but also for getting out to the to St. Michael's Mount, which is just off the coast. When the tide was in, they could carry out the tin in these coracles, and then on the other side of the island, that the big ships would be able to pick the tin up and take it elsewhere. Diodorus' quotation of Posidonius, who travelled to Britain about 80 BC, describes the metalworkers of Cornwall carrying the tin to a certain island lying off the coast of Britain called Mictus. At this island, the merchants buy the tin from the natives and carry it across into Gaul. In the native pronunciation of Michael, the CH was probably pronounced K. Michael would then have been Mickle, and so Mictus. And finally, the prophetic blessing of Jacob upon Asher, Genesis 49:20, and that of Moses, Deuteronomy 33:24, have been amply fulfilled. Above ground, olives and oil in Palestine, and beneath, iron and copper in Britain. And I was trying to work that out, and I was thinking, well, it must have been Moses, this second one. Because they didn't really know about iron at the time, because that was the Iron Age, wasn't it? And we're really sort of talking about the Bronze Age here, and yet, this sort of foretold that they were going to find iron and copper somewhere, and they did. They had tin in Britain.
So how would they have known the words to use then? Because
Well, it must have been a rare substance. They must have known of it, but it can't have been about in enough of a enough quantity for it to be used for making lots of implements.
Right. So it's like understanding of a certain gemstone or whatnot, and then obviously upon discovering the amounts of it, that is when you begin to develop it and form it into new technologies.
Yeah. And it says here, and beneath iron and copper. And in Britain was responsible for 2/3 of the world's copper in the 19th century. It all came from Britain. So it wasn't just tin that we had here. It was copper as well. And these substances were worth a lot of money or a lot of wealth in the ancient world because they were required for making everything. You know, you needed copper and tin, and then you can make bronze, and you've got a wealth of it in Britain. The tinners were that important that they had their own parliaments, known as the stannaries, that were guarded by a warden whose office was hereditary. According to Sir George Harris in the Stannaries in Cornwall, the origin of their constitution is lost in preceding ages of unfathomable antiquity. Special laws for tin miners predate written legal codes in Britain, and ancient traditions exempted everyone connected with tin mining in Cornwall and Devon from any jurisdiction other than the stannary courts in all but the most exceptional of circumstances. So, you know, the country understood how important it was that we had these tin miners, so they were above the law. And these stannaries, they only stopped being used, I think, a couple of hundred years ago, and somebody in the 70s tried to start them up again and veto the legislation in Parliament because they took precedence to it. These stannaries did. It's a shame that they didn't get away with it, but they said, well, to have somebody that you have to have somebody as a guardian, the warden, you have to have the warden to have these stannaries operating, and that office is vacant and it's a hereditary office. So because you don't actually have somebody in that office, you cannot claim your veto over the parliament. But it's still there in law that the stannaries take precedence.
Yeah, I wonder, I mean, why do you think that was? And I mean, it's obviously to protect them. I mean, was it basically because there was such a value, an asset to society? So
you imagine if you lost the guys that knew how to make the tin, the country would have lost its gold mine. I mean, it was the equivalent of a gold mine, basically, having all this tin and copper. We didn't actually have gold, but we had the next best thing.
Yeah. I guess it's like, how could you equate it to a trade today that tend to get away with murder?
I don't know, but maybe oil. But also, if you think, in Sumer, they had lots of gold, didn't they? Now, I don't know where they got that gold from, but they had masses and masses and masses of gold. And yet they had no copper and no tin in that area. So, you know, this copper and this tin may have been worth more than gold at the time. It's certainly worth preserving.
Possibly. If it was used to produce more things and then it spawned on bigger economies, then it was more likely going to be of more value.
And it must have been fiercely guarded. I mean, the secret of where they were getting the tin from was fiercely guarded. But also the island itself must have been heavily defended. And of course, the British were experts at defence. They defeated the Romans twice. We were very, expert soldiers. It's another thing that kids aren't taught today. And we have another tradition with the tin as well. A Cornish tradition is to the effect that Joseph of Arimathea came in a boat to Cornwall and brought the boy Jesus with him. And he taught Jesus how to extract tin and purge it of the wolfram. In honour of that legend, when the tin is flashed, the tinner shouts, "Joseph was in the trade." We find this legend again at Priddy, a little village lying at the top of the Mendip Hills, right in the centre of the ancient lead and copper mining area. So hundreds of years later, when the tin was flashed, whenever these tinners flash the tin and get the tin out from where they're smelting it, that's what they say when they see it. They shout out, "Joseph was in the trade." And that was the tradition. That's just one of them. There's loads, and there's no smoke without fire.
So you think that that saying, it comes directly from the story that of Jesus?
That's what they say. They said, well, it comes from Joseph. They say that the tin miners said that Joseph was involved in the tin trade, and he brought Jesus here, and he showed him how to flash the tin. On its own, you would say, oh, yeah, well, that's not very believable. But as we'll see, there's loads more evidence here. Various historians of early times, such as St Gildas and William of Malmesbury, record that the British king Arviragus granted to Joseph of Arimathea a considerable area at Glastonbury to be held forever free from all taxes, as a site for a church and its accessory buildings and fields. That this is no mere legend is proved by one of the greatest official records of all British history. After conquering England in the year 1066 AD, William the Conqueror had a survey made of all the lands of the kingdom as to what taxes they had paid. This record, called the Domesday Book, was completed in 1088 AD, and it contains this record. The Domus Dei in the great monastery of Glastonbury called the Secret of the Lord. This Glastonbury church possesses in its own villa 12 hides of land which have never paid tax. And that's the 12 hides of land that are referred to by the historians. I actually did an Albion narration audio book on Glastonbury, on the traditions of Glastonbury. So if anybody's interested in learning about the history of Glastonbury, the Christian history of Glastonbury, there's a 7 or 8 part narration that I did that goes into a lot of detail and that also talks about Joseph of Arimathea. But that was his connection to Glastonbury. So we've got those various historians that mention it. We got Maelgwyn of Llandaff, the Lord of Anglesey and Snowdonia. In AD 450, he tells us that Joseph of Arimathea, the noble Decurion, entered his perpetual sleep with his 11 companions in the Isle of Avalon. And that has always been understood to be Glastonbury, but there are some Welsh researchers that say that it's actually somewhere outside of Cardiff that it is being referred to here. So it's difficult to tell, but what we do know is that he's referring to Joseph of Arimathea is buried somewhere here in Britain. And this was written in 450 AD. And the eminent historian of the Roman Catholic Church, Cardinal Baronius, 1538 to 1607, who became the curator of the Vatican Library in 1597, wrote in his Ecclesiastical Annals, in that year, AD 36, the year of the great persecution in Jerusalem and the dispersion that followed, the party of Joseph of Arimathea and those who went with him into exile was put out to sea in a vessel without sail or oars. This vessel drifted and finally reached Marseille, where they were saved. From Marseille, Joseph and his company passed into Britain and, after preaching the gospel there, died. And he's known as one of the greatest historians of history, this Cardinal Baronius. And the Christmas carol, I saw three ships come sailing in, that's what it's supposedly referring to, is Joseph of Arimathea coming into Britain. And the Christianity that he brought was before St. Paul. So it was a different Christianity to the Roman Catholic one, which is why when St. Augustine came to Britain in the 6th century, he said that the Christians that were already here, they didn't practice baptism and they had Easter at a different date and it was all slightly different. And that's the reason why it was slightly different, because it was brought over here before St. Paul. It was brought over here in AD 36. And the first nation to proclaim themselves Christian was the British nation, and it was King Lucius, and that was in 170 AD. And that was why Britain was the first nation to proclaim itself Christian, is because it was one of the first countries that the apostle came to, Joseph of Arimathea. And there's Lazarus is also linked in with it, I believe.
Yeah, I wonder if there were any, if there's any literature or ancient scripts that's kind of not canon, quite canon, but still kind of attributes a tribute to their faith in any way. There must be some form of scripts that have existed. Maybe
there's the life
washed out now.
I think there's a life of St. Mary Magdalene. It wasn't actually written at the time, but that talks about it. Historians William of Malmesbury and Polydor Virgil also placed Joseph of Arimathea at Glastonbury. Even the church councils held at Pisa in 1409, Constance 1417, Siena 1434, and Basel 1434 ruled that the churches of France and Spain must yield in points of antiquity and precedence to that of Britain, as the latter church was founded by Joseph of Arimathea immediately after the Passion of Christ. And again, there are references. It says here that there's Gildas, but there are other references which say that Christianity was brought here in the time of Tiberius Caesar. And there's another quote from Taliesin the Bard, who says that while Christianity was a new thing in the East, there never was a time that the Druids of Britain were not following it, which is basically saying that Druidism and the early belief system that the Britons had the same morality as Christianity. I mean, there are various people that were writing, of these church fathers that were writing in the 2nd, 3rd and the 4th century, that make mention of Britain being Christian. There's also Bede, when he writes his history for the Anglo-Saxons, and he mentions in there that Britain's been Christian since King Lucius, which we can date to 170 AD. But I don't think there are any pseudo-gospels or pseudo-epistles that mention right. it, if that's what you were referring to.
Yeah, pretty much. So, it would have been word of mouth. And again, just kind of certifies the research that we've done here in the established routes, and trade with the trade routes, you're going to get mixtures of people, and the information would pass would flow quicker, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, you understand. Everything was connected up. They knew about these things. They had they had church councils where they would discuss these things. And the early history of the church, I forget which podcast I did where I talked about it, but the actual missionaries that actually came out from Britain, there was one that went to the Goths, and they had a Gothic Bible, and there was one that went to Helvetia in Switzerland, and another famous one. And they actually left from Britain in the second and the third century. And all of this is before Rome became Christian. This is why it doesn't get talked about, because it precedes Rome becoming Christian, which was in the third or the fourth century. But this yeah. term, nobilis decurio, that Malguin of Llandaff mentions when he talks about Joseph of Arimathea, this is important. In the Latin Vulgate of the Gospel of Mark and Luke, we find the term decurio used instead of council member to describe Joseph's office or occupation. In Jerome's translation of the Vulgate, the term nobilis decurio is used, the noble decurio. Not only that, but early documents of Britain and Gaul also refer to Joseph in the same manner. The Welshman Malguin of Llandaff calls Joseph the nobilis decurio, as well as Rabanus Maurus, the Archbishop of Mayence, and the writer of the manuscript called The Life of St. Mary Magdalene. And I believe that wasn't written until the 7th or the 8th century. Gildas Badonicus, one of the earliest British historians, also refers to Joseph as nobilis decurio. So what does this Latin title mean? In the Roman Empire of the time of the Messiah, the term decurio was commonly used to designate an official under Roman authority who was in charge of metal mining. The implication is that Joseph was a provincial Roman senator in charge of Rome's overseas mining interests. Ivor C. Fletcher adds that the office seems to have been a lucrative and much coveted one. Cicero, the Roman writer, statesman, and orator, remarked that it was easier to become a senator of Rome than a decurio in Pompeii. And that's from The Incredible History of God's True Church. The office of decurio is also known to have existed under the Roman occupation in Britain. It is an historical fact that tin was mined and exported to the European continent in large quantities from Cornwall during the Roman period, and the Encyclopaedia Britannica reports that tin was imported from Cornwall into Italy after, if not before, the invasion of Britain by Julius Caesar. The tin mines of Cornwall were a major source of this metal, and in Roman times the metal was in great demand and vital for the empire because tin was used in the making of alloys. So we have a lot of circumstantial evidence here, and we have the fact that Joseph was referred to as a nobilis decurio. And some people have said that does that really actually have any link to metal mining? But it's saying that he was an official under the Roman authority, and somewhere along the way it's been linked with metals and precious metals. So that looks needs more looking into, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's another thread of evidence, isn't it? Because it puts it close into the realm of possibility for the point you made earlier of Jesus, or you know, Jesus as a boy having a trip to Britain.
Well, yeah, you also get these tunic crosses in Cornwall which show Jesus as a boy with a tunic on, with a boy's tunic on. So why do they have these crosses with him dressed as a boy? And you've got the hymn Jerusalem that asks whether Jesus walked in Britain. And you get at Glastonbury, you get the Jesus Maria stone. There's all sorts of legends that Jesus came to Britain alongside Joseph of Arimathea. And the reason why Joseph came to Britain and had access to Britain is because he was a tin merchant. That's what he was involved in. That's why he was so wealthy, because don't forget, he was incredibly wealthy. And he was also on the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. And he had his own, he had his own plot of land and the place to put the tomb in. Yeah, he argued for Jesus at the Sanhedrin, and then had to disappear and make his getaway once the Galileans started being persecuted.
Right, and then that's when they went into poverty, right? Because they was in hiding. Obviously, then King Herod was. He couldn't have gone public if he was from wealth. He couldn't have.
Joseph of Arimathea, yeah. I think he was a secret benefactor of Christ's movement. In his book entitled Roman Britain, I.A. Richmond tells of the development and growth of the British tin industry and trade with the continent of Europe. Much of the most famed of British metals in the days before the Roman occupation was tin. The vivid accounts by Diodorus Siculus of overland packhorse transport of the tin from the Gallic coast to Narbonne in the 1st century BC and of the island Emporium on the British coast from which the merchants obtained it all speak of a brisk and flourishing early trade monopolised in Caesar's day by the Veneti of Brittany. And again, when I did this podcast talking about the Romans, it goes into detail about these Veneti tradesmen in France that were picking up the tin, and they were also involved in fighting for the Romans. And basically, Caesar wanted to take over this trade. He didn't want the Veneti being responsible for this. He wanted it for himself. And the Veneti were loyal to Britain, and they wouldn't actually give Caesar any details of our military formations and, you know, the size of our army and all that sort of thing. They wouldn't tell him that, but he did know that there was a lot of wealth here, and that's why he wanted to take over. Diodorus Siculus himself, in his book 5 of the History of the World, details the British tin industry. He says, they that inhabit the British promontory of Belerium, which is the old name for Cornwall, by reason of their converse with merchants, are more civilized and courteous to strangers than the rest. These are the people that make the tin, which with a great deal of care and labour they dig out of the ground, and that being rocky, the metal is mixed with some veins of earth, out of which they melt the metal and then refine it. Then they beat it into 4 square pieces like a die, and carry it to a British isle near at hand called Mictus. For at low tide, all being dry between them and the island, they convey over in carts an abundance of tin. But there is one thing that is peculiar to these islands, which lie between Britain and Europe. For at full sea they appear to be islands, but at low water for a long way they look like so many peninsulas. Hence the merchants transport the tin they buy of the inhabitants of Gaul, and for 30 days' journey they carry it in packs upon horses' backs through Gaul to the mouth of the River Rhone. And I think he's probably talking about the Scilly Isles there on the way over to France. And again, or maybe not the Scilly Isles, maybe even the Jersey and Guernsey. He's certainly talking about some other islands there rather than St. Michael's Mount. And again, this tin metal is transported out of Britain into Gaul, the merchants carrying it on horseback through the heart of Celtica to Marseille and the city called Narbonne. And that's from Diodorus Siculus Booth's translation. So you can see there was, it, you know, it was like ancient globalization, isn't it, really? It had been picked up from Britain, yeah, taken all the way through France, and then it would get to the Fertile Crescent. The promontory, yeah, of Cornwall is rich in the remains of old mine workings and debris like the Ding Dong Mine, which can be traced to a high antiquity. The oldest crude pits containing smelted tin are called Jews' houses, the tradition being that the tin mines of Cornwall were wrought by the Jews with pickaxes of holm, box and hartshorn, tools which are sometimes found amongst the rubble of such works, and these date to very remote times. There is hardly a tin-bearing spot in Cornwall that has not been worked over by the, quote, old men, as the ancient miners of the land are always called. Quote, upon whatever spot the old miner has worked, there we are told the Phoenician has been, or the Jew has mined. The existence of the terms Jews' houses, Jews' tin, and Jews' leavings prove the connection of what they knew as Jews with the Cornish miners. And that's from Romances of the West, 1872. In Paul Healy's History of Cornwall, Falmouth, 1803, we read that the oldest smelting places are called Jews' houses. The old blocks of tin occasionally found are called Jews' pieces, and the stream works of tin that have been formerly deserted by the labourers are called Jews' works. All through the land of Cornwall, the ancient presence and influence of the Jews is marked by names in places like Boduan, abode of the Jews, Traduus, Jews' village, and Market Jew. These, as well as the historical Jewish windows in St. Neot's Church and other Jewish monuments and memories, abundantly supplement the older traditions of the Jews' houses and Jews' leavings. And I would add that there's another connection to ancient Israel with the town that's called Marazion, which is right near St. Michael's Mount. And when we bear in mind that Jews didn't actually come to Britain until 1066. So this is not talking about the modern day Jews. These words for all these things to do with tin has to go back to Judah. It has to go back to, you know, 1,000 years before Christ, basically.
Yeah, that's what I was going to suggest, because obviously we know that a Jew is just a short an abbreviation for Judean, right?
Yeah.
So they must have been referring to, Judah was the southern province of Israel, so the southern kingdom of Israel. So it must have had quite a, kind of high prominence in terms of, you know, the people would have been regarded as of Judah, wouldn't they? I mean,
yeah. Well, if we don't find traces of anything to do with Phoenicia, but we do find traces of people referring to anything to do with the tin, they're referring to it as Jews. And now today, the Bible just tells us that they're all Jews, doesn't it? And that's what the people would have understood it as. So the word, whatever the word was that they used back then, as the language evolved, it became Jews. Because they knew that's what they were talking about. What they were talking about was Israelites, and that word would have become Jews, because I'm not sure exactly what word they would have used 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago, but as it evolved over time, and as we became Christianized and we learnt this, the story of the Bible, that's when they would have changed the word to being Jew. I mean, it was probably something like Yehuda.
It essentially became synonymous with anyone from Israel, which is not quite accurate, but you can see the roots.
Yeah, I mean the Edomites thing and all the rest of that didn't happen until 200 years before Christ. But when we were talking about this mining, you're talking about 2500 BC to 1500 BC. 1500 BC is when the Israelites took over from the Phoenicians, and then you've got 1200 years of mining, basically, which would have been carried out by these Israelites, and they have left the name Jew everywhere, or Judah it would have been.
So because Judah was the flag carrier for the faith, wasn't it, back then? Judah maintained the religious traditions, so I don't know if they continued the religious practices of the Ten Commandments and such, and you know, for them to get given that title or to be put in that bracket, not just ethnically but religiously as well. What do you think?
I don't know. Judah was the royal line. The scepter was never supposed to disappear from Judah. I just think whatever the word was that they used, it was associated with Israel, it was associated with Judah, and over time it just became Jew, because that was the word that we associated with them. But when you think, as I say, this is from 1500 BC up until 500 BC, because Jerusalem was sacked in around about 500 BC. So you had 1,000 years basically of this tribe of Asher that was coming here and working with the people that were already here and in these mines, and that was the name that we have today for these pieces. All to do with the tin is all to do with Jews and the town of Marazion. And if you look at the Jewish history, they'll tell you that the Jews didn't come into Britain until 1066. So it's not talking about modern Jews here. It's not talking about Edomite Canaanite Jews. It's talking about Israelites. But because the word we use today is Jew for all of them. I mean, they probably didn't know the difference ethnically back then either, so they just used this same word.
I guess the point I was making is, would they have still been following the religious practices?
Well, I think they were pagan, weren't they? Because they were pagan, that's why they were kicked out from Jerusalem, kicked out from Israel and Judah, and were taken over by Assyria and Babylon is because they'd fallen into pagan ways. So there may have been, there may not have been. Later on, the group that left through the Straits of the Euphrates, they wanted to go back to their original laws and their original beliefs, and they wanted to find a new land where they could do that. And they went through the Straits of the Euphrates in the north. So they were looking to do the right thing. But if you look at Jeremiah, it tells you that the people that were invaded, they were doing things like dressing trees up with baubles and decorations, so that they were decorating Christmas trees, essentially. Mm-hmm. The same sort of thing that we're doing today. But the Druids, as we pointed out before, they had connections with the Levites because they had sacrifices, they believed in the eternal soul, they believed in sin, and they wouldn't worship idols either, and they refused to worship Caesar as a god. They said, "How can you worship a man as a god? And God is everywhere." So they had all these connections to the Old Testament beliefs. So I don't know what faith they would have had, or whether it would have been any different to what faith the Britons had. But we do know that there's this connection here. There's all these different connections here, and next week we'll get into some more of them, and we'll talk some more about Joseph of Arimathea, because there's a lot more to do with him yet anyway. But I think we should leave that here now. We've gone a little bit over time. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks' time, because next week there is the Patriotic Alternative Monthly Update. So we will see you then. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.